We'll hear argument now in the case of Anderson against Aon Corporation.
Good morning.
Mr. Skillman.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Everett Skillman for appellant. I'd like to reserve approximately 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In this present case, Aon Corporation went to Irvine, California to buy my client's insurance brokerage business. The purchase price was approximately 95,000 shares of Aon Corporation stock. That occurred in October 1997. Unbeknownst to my client, Aon Corporation and various of its subsidiaries, specifically Aon Risk and Peter Arkley and so on, were engaging in improper business practices, improper revenue recognition, breaches of broker fiduciary duty, and other misdeeds that, if they had been known to the general public, would have caused the price of stock to be severely compromised. As a result of the information becoming known, the price of the stock lost approximately three-quarters of its value. It has really never recovered. I just picked up the USA Today, and it's still down in the 40s. So my client filed suit in the Orange County Superior Court in the state of California for damages under causes of action pursuant to a California Supreme Court case called Small versus Fritz, which says that a holder of stock may sue where he acted in reliance on the corporation's statements in holding his or her stock. That is exactly what occurred in the present case. Inadvertently, a cause of action under federal law, RICO, was included in the complaint. That prompted my opponent.
What do you mean inadvertently? The word processor just dumped it in there?
Well, apparently Mr. O'Keefe overlooked the fact that that cause of action, it was about the fourth or fifth cause of action, and it was in there. When it was discovered that it was in there, it was promptly dismissed. That was done by the plaintiff, and it was done without a court order pursuant to Rule 41A. Rule 41A says that it is, quote, the plaintiff, unquote, that may dismiss a cause of action before an answer or a motion for summary judgment is filed, and that that dismissal is effective without a court order. Therefore, by the time the motion to remand was filed, there was no federal cause of action, and there was no diversity of citizenship. Therefore, pursuant to Section 1446 of the Federal Code,
but 1446 doesn't have anything to do with whether a court has supplemental jurisdiction. It just says that if there is no jurisdiction, then a remand is essential. Did you try to analyze this under the supplemental jurisdiction statute?
At the time of the motion to remand, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
But that's the question, whether this comes within a permissible retention of jurisdiction under 1367. I notice your brief doesn't discuss 1367 either.
That is also true, Your Honor. 1367.
I don't understand where we're going. All 1447 says is that if there's no subject matter jurisdiction, then remand. But whether there's subject matter jurisdiction is the domain of 1367.
There was no federal cause of action, and there was no diversity of citizenship.
Have you read 1367?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says that if the case was originally based on a federal claim, the dismissal of the federal claim does not end federal subject matter jurisdiction, though it gives the district court discretion. Now, one might say that discretion was abused here, but I don't understand you to be arguing that.
1367C3 says that if the court dismisses all of the federal cause of action, if the court dismisses the federal cause of action, it may retain the case. In the present case, the court did not dismiss the federal cause of action. Plaintiff did. Therefore, there was no discretion under 1367. If I could address your concerns, Your Honor, I would be more than happy to do so.
I wish you had discussed 1367 in your brief. You took an ostrich's posture. You ignored the controlling statute and kind of wish we would ignore it, too. But, right, if you want to discuss 1367, you need to collect the cases to address the question whether a dismissal by plaintiff disables a district court from exercising the 1367C discretion and so on. It's a little late when you get to oral argument, having ignored it in the briefs.
Your Honor, we did discuss the discretionary aspect of whether a court could retain jurisdiction after the plaintiff dismisses a federal cause of action.
I think you probably need to move on to the merits.
Very well, Your Honor.
My big question for you is whether you are conceding that there is a conflict between Illinois and California law.
Yes, I concede that. Absolutely. And under the Washington Mutual case,
I don't think that's your best argument would be to deny that there's a conflict between the two. But if you concede it, there we are. Right? The problem in this case is that I can't see any conflict between California and Illinois law. There is a difference about whether private actions are allowed, but securities fraud is illegal in Illinois. Illinois and California have different views about whether there should be private actions or whether the prosecution should be limited to public prosecutions. And whether that's a conflict is actually an interesting question, a parallel issue under antitrust law, where California had a different rule for recovery of damages, but the underlying question about what is a cartel was the same under multiple states' law. The Supreme Court held that there was no conflict. That's California against ARC America. And I was wondering if you were making a parallel argument here, but evidently not.
California law says that a holder may sue for damages. Illinois law says that a holder may not sue for damages. In the present case, under the choice of law rules of the Trent.
That's why I cited California against ARC America. That was the issue in ARC America, and the Supreme Court held, 9-0, that that was not a conflict, that the difference in private recovery is not a conflict. There has to be a conflict in the underlying substantive norm. And since both California and Illinois prohibit fraud, there seems to be no difference in the underlying substantive norm. But as you're not making this argument, there's no point in pursuing it.
Illinois and California law differ in what constitutes reliance in order to support the fraud cause of action, Your Honor. In California, you can rely on disclosures to the extent that you hold the stock. And in Illinois, there has to be a transaction of some sort in order to prove reliance. And in the absence of that transaction, there is no fraud cause of action in Illinois. California says, pursuant to the restatement second of torts, that forbearance, and I believe it's correctly so, that forbearance can, in fact, be a valid form of reliance that will support a fraud cause of action. The essential elements of fraud are different in Illinois and in California. The Ferens case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, says that that when there's a transfer of venue, the transferee court must follow the choice of law rules that existed in the transferor court. The transferor court here was a Central District of California. In California, the rule is, in determining whether there's a conflict of law and how they choose between these two conflicts of law, under the Washington Mutual case, first you have to figure out, is there a conflict? If there's no conflict, then you don't even look at the choice of law issue. You first analyze, is there a conflict? In the present case, there is a conflict. California says a holder can sue. Illinois says a holder can't sue. The second, you have to figure out which jurisdiction has a greater governmental interest. Here, California has the greater governmental interest in protecting its citizens from being defrauded out of their business. And since that's the basic underlying gut of this case, that itself provides ground for reversal. And, Your Honor, I'll reserve the remaining minutes of my time for rebuttal. If the court has any further questions at this time, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly, Mr. Skillman. Mr. Grodman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Dane Drobny on behalf of the defendants at Belize. I'd like to start this morning by saying that once again, as he has been throughout this case, plaintiff is haunted by his own decisions relating to the type of claims that he pleads and the issues that he raises. As Your Honors pointed out this morning already, plaintiff has not challenged in these proceedings the district court's exercise of jurisdiction under 1367, which is the operative statute. Instead, what he argues is that the district court was compelled to remand the case under 1447 because it lacked jurisdiction. The district court never lacked jurisdiction. Plaintiff's complaint conferred jurisdiction on the district court by raising a claim arising under federal law under Section 1331. That case was removed, and this court judges jurisdiction at the time of removal. When the case was removed, it included a RICO claim, which plaintiff now curiously claims was inadvertent. That wasn't the first federal claim that he pled. 2 years earlier, he pled a claim under the federal securities laws. 2 years later, in his second complaint, he pled a claim under RICO. 3 years later, in the third complaint that he's not challenging this morning, he pled a claim again under the federal securities laws. One thing has been consistent in each of his filings, and that is pleading claims under federal law. The fact that he did that in his second complaint dooms his efforts this morning to try and get his case remanded. Why? Exactly the reason that's already been pointed out. 1367 provides the court with the discretion to keep the case in federal court. The court properly exercised that discretion. The court never lacked jurisdiction. As it never lacked jurisdiction, it was not compelled to remand the case. Accordingly, since the district court under 1367 had the discretion to retain the case, and plaintiff is not here admittedly challenging that discretion was abused, he's out of luck and the case cannot be remanded. Moreover, this court need not even reach that issue. It need not even reach whether the district court in California abused its discretion or not. Why? Again, because of plaintiff's own decisions and the way he pled his complaint. His third complaint raises an issue arising under federal law. He invoked purposefully and voluntarily this court's jurisdiction under 28 U.S. Code Section 1331. When he did that, under this court's decision in Bernstein v. Lind-Waldeck, he waived his right to contest the district court's earlier decision in California denying remand. He's not been able to distinguish the Bernstein case or come up with an argument as to why that waiver is not effective. So the jurisdictional issue, which he's trying to raise, is not a jurisdictional issue. It's an issue of abuse of discretion, and that challenge has been waived. Moving on to the choice of law issue, again, plaintiff did not and has conceded throughout these proceedings that there is a conflict between the law of California and the law of Illinois. Again, he's haunted by that decision, and he is simply arguing before this court whose interests are more impaired. Is it the state of California or is it the state of Illinois? The district court in Illinois, as well as the district court in California, looked at this issue. The district court in California issued a tentative ruling on the issue. The district court in Illinois addressed it substantively. Both courts concluded that looking at the third, under the third prong of the California, under California's government interest test, the laws of Illinois were more impaired. Why? This morning, plaintiff is telling this court that his case is about a transaction that occurred in 1997 when Ann bought his client's business. That's not what he said in any of his complaints. What he has said in his complaints is that this case is about misrepresentations that occurred in 1999, 2000, 2001, and 2002 relating to the value of Aon's stock. The transaction in 1997 in which Aon purchased his company has never been at issue. Representations, misrepresentations, disclosures, omissions during that transaction have never been raised. Whether that transaction occurred in California or didn't occur in California, there's no evidence on the record to support either conclusion. Instead, what's been at issue throughout this case is misrepresentations that occurred in Illinois, that emanated in Illinois, that were approved in Illinois from 1999 through 2002. Those misrepresentations fix the law applicable to this case under the government interest test and its third prong. Why? Because courts look at the place of wrong in determining which state's law to apply. And when looking at the place of wrong in a fraud case, it is settled that that place of wrong is the place where the fraud occurred because the state has an interest in making sure that citizens are protected from fraud that occurs within its borders. For that reason,
I still have trouble seeing the conflict. Maybe the concession takes this out of the case, but Illinois doesn't set itself up as a haven for fraud. Illinois is not some offshore Caribbean island that sponsors fraud. Right? Fraud is as illegal in Illinois as in California. The only difference is they have a different choice in whether the prosecution of fraud is done by private citizens or by public officials. And I don't understand why that is a conflict.
I believe it's a conflict. It's an interesting issue, Judge, and Your Honor, and I believe it's a conflict for this reason. Plaintiff, who is the party here, would have no standing to bring his case in Illinois. The reason he would have no standing to bring his case in Illinois is because the Illinois securities laws and Illinois common law follows the federal securities laws when it comes to actions relating to a security. It's undisputed that the federal securities laws do not represent a holder's action.
You're not following my question. It is clear that Illinois does not allow private actions by holders for securities fraud. We're just assuming that. The question I asked of Mr. Skillman, and I'm asking of you, is why the difference in the choice between public and private enforceability is a conflict. The question in California against ARC America was whether California's choice to allow private actions, private antitrust actions, in a set of circumstances where federal law would limit to public antitrust actions, created a conflict between California and federal law. And the justices answered no, but the conflict had to concern the substantive rule of decision and not who the enforcer of the law was. And I'm trying to figure out whether that principle isn't equally applicable here, where we have a choice between public and private enforcers, but apparently no difference in the substantive rule.
Your Honor, I believe there is a difference in the substantive rule, and the reason I believe there's a difference in the substantive rule is because the plaintiff would have no right to enforce his case in Illinois.
You're just not getting it.
Your Honor, I understand what you're saying. A state prosecutor could prosecute the fraud in Illinois and in California. I understand that to be your point, but I do believe it creates a conflict because he wouldn't have the right to bring his case in Illinois.
Well, it sounds like you would decide ARC America differently than the Supreme Court did, but generally we follow the Supreme Court.
And as well you should, Judge. In any event, he has not challenged the conflict issue, and he also has raised Illinois law in his third complaint. he brought a cause of action under Illinois law in his third complaint. So in his third complaint, he told the court that Illinois law should apply to his case. Suppose he won. Suppose he prevailed on his third complaint. If he prevailed on his third complaint, he wouldn't come before this court and says Illinois law doesn't apply. The fraud emanated from California. He would say Illinois law does apply. So once again, for that reason, I believe he raised the choice of law issue as well. And that's all I have this morning, unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Skillman?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to address a couple of points raised by my opponent with regard to the waiver argument and with regard to the various instances in which federal causes of action were pled. Those causes of action were pled in the Third Amendment complaint under the cloud of the, quote, cautioning, unquote, that Rule 11 obligations had to be met. When a judge says the phrase Rule 11, counsel's ears perk up and you pretty much have to obey what the federal judge says. And it was under those restraints that the causes of action pursuant to Illinois law and under federal law were pled. And there was case law that we cited in our reply brief, Your Honor, that says that where there was some sort of a coercion to plead certain causes of action, that in itself will not constitute a waiver of any sort of issue later on in the case or in the appeal. Also on the issue of waiver, Your Honor, you mentioned that 1367C was not brought up at the lower court. I reread the motion, the opposition to the motion remand, and I reread Judge Selna's October 17, 2005 order. There's not one single mention whatsoever of 1367C. Therefore, it would be unusual for us to bring up a straw man only for us to have to tear it down. That is basically a counterargument that we would have to deal with. We made it very clear that there was no subject matter jurisdiction because there's no diversity and no federal cause of action. It was not incumbent upon us to raise a counterargument before an initial argument by the defense was even raised. Therefore, there's no waiver of any sort of issue. The Carlsbad case, which fully elucidates the judge's discretion pursuant to 1367C, was decided after our appellant's brief was filed. That case didn't even exist at the time we filed our appellant's brief. After it was made known to us, we fully explained in our appellant's reply brief why the reasoning of Carlsbad does not apply here, because it's two different sorts of dismissals altogether. One is a dismissal by the court. One is a dismissal by the plaintiff without a court order. Therefore, the reasoning of the two types of instances are not the same. Under the reasoning of the Carlsbad case, for example, once a federal judge grants a motion to dismiss under 12b-6 and disposes of the federal cause of action, the federal judge has fully reviewed the pleadings, the merits, done the legal research, and fully knows the ins and outs of that case on a substantive level. When you have a dismissal by the plaintiff under Rule 41, the federal judge hasn't even seen the case until he or she picks up the file.
Hadn't the judge in this case seen it a couple of years prior to that, though?
That is true, Your Honor, in a prior case.
But it's really the same case, isn't it?
Well, the allegations relate to some of the same events, yes, Your Honor. But still, the reasoning of the Carlsbad case does not apply in the present case, Your Honor, because it's two different types of dismissals. Furthermore, there is no subject matter jurisdiction by virtue of waiver, estoppel, or any other sort of common law doctrine like that. That's very clear from the Kokanen case and various other cases that we cited in our brief. With regard to the conflict of law issue, Your Honor, we would like to point out that this is basically a sale of a business gone bad. It's a sale of a business gone bad. We received, or my client received, Aon Corporation stock. That stock was highly inflated. If Aon Corporation had been above board with their disclosures,
if it was inflated at the time you sold the business, then you would be a purchaser. But you concede that you're not a purchaser. So I don't understand that line of argument.
The price of the stock dropped at the time my client was a holder.
No, look, as a matter of federal securities law, if you sell a business to somebody in exchange for stock and the stock is overvalued at the time of the sale, you have every right to sue under 10b-5 because you are, in fact, a purchaser of a stock that whose value has been inflated by fraud. By characterizing your client in this case as a holder rather than a purchaser, you've given up that theory. So I don't understand what the point you're making is.
Yes, Your Honor. I see my time is up. May I respond quickly? Yes.
Pending question.
There was no 10b-5 cause of action in the present case, Your Honor. This was a claim that was filed in Orange County Superior Court in California.
You're not dealing with my question, however. Thank you very much.
I apologize. Thank you.
The case is taken under advice.